want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for clicking on this in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. It's part two of our two-part series with science writer and investigative reporter Peter Byrne about his 11-part series published in the Point Reyes Light here in California called Busted: Breast Cancer, Money, and the Media. And we continue our conversation about the alleged spike in breast cancer reports here in Marin County, California. It was once described, in a high exaggeration, as the breast cancer capital of the world. And Peter Byrne has dug into the myth of that claim and shares more of his investigation with us in this second installment. Before we get started, I always like to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Joey Perillo, Carl Hesterberg. Also, I want to thank Olivier de Merlu. He lives in Switzerland and is a very generous supporter of the Peter B. Collins podcast. I'd like you to follow their lead. Come on over to my website. It's peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button and then become a subscriber. And on that page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution like Olivier did of any amount using PayPal. And if you don't like PayPal, you can mail me a check or a money order or cash. The P.O. box is listed on that page. However you choose to support me, I hope you will, and I very much appreciate it. Thank you, Aretha. Welcome to part two of our two-part podcast series based on Peter Byrne's investigative series published at the Point Reyes Light called Busted, about breast cancer, money, and the media. And Peter has done a deep investigation and concludes that the allegations that Marin County was the breast cancer capital of the world and that we had a huge cluster of cases here is not accurate. And, Peter, I imagine you haven't made a lot of friends in the community of public health and the nonprofits that are focused on eradicating cancer and raising breast cancer awareness. And it seems that some people pushed back on you that this is inconvenient and that it might cause some women not to get a mammogram or other breast exam. And I can just imagine the kind of defensiveness that you have encountered as you have attempted to find the truth about these issues.
That's true. I interviewed all the leading epidemiologists on this, and I also interviewed the leading breast cancer activist organizations, you know, their leaders in the Bay Area. And they all universally insisted that white women get more breast cancer than anybody else. And I would say, why? And they go, because the statistics at the cancer registry show that. And I'm like, but those statistics are flawed. And they're like, well, we don't know that. And indeed, they probably didn't know it, because the internal audits that I got, I had to squeeze out of the registry, you know, threaten lawsuits and all sorts of stuff until I got them. They're not disclosed to the public. They're not disclosed to researchers that are relying on the accuracy of the data. And I think it was news to these activists and these scientists that the registry data is flawed. Although there have been studies of the California registry that said that the data was not fit for research purposes, and that the public would indeed be outraged if they knew how unfit it was. But those are studies that appeared in professional journals that the public doesn't read. And there's kind of this code of camaraderie, I guess, among the epidemiologists in the Bay Area. They all work together and, you know, co-author stuff, and they're reluctant to criticize each other. I was a little bit put off by Breast Cancer Fund in particular when I interviewed their leading scientists who were claiming that wealthy white women get more breast cancer, and they had no knowledge whatsoever about the impact of mammographic utilization.
Mm-hmm.
Groups like that, you know, have gotten pretty wealthy. That group, Breast Cancer Fund, has a floor on a downtown office building in San Francisco, and, you know, I'm sure they are well recompensed, and they should be. But one of the reasons it became clear to me interviewing Zero Breast Cancer and Breast Cancer Fund that they hold so tightly to this 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer statistics is because it's a fundraising mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
When I interviewed Janice Barlow, who was the executive director until recently of Zero Breast Cancer here in Marin County, she said that was indeed true. And then, you know, I asked her why her organization had taken close to $1 million from the Avon Foundation for Women. And she said, well, that was a hard decision for our board. And at the end, we decided, well, we all wear makeup, and this will be a teaching opportunity for Avon, as if, you know, they were going to teach Avon what the right thing to do was when they were taking Avon's money. Which also leads us into the fact that Avon gave well over $4 million to the Marin Department of Health to conduct a series of studies, the biggest one being the so-called Marin Women Study,
mm-hmm.
looking for the causations of breast cancer in Marin that were non-existent.
So, Peter, at a certain point, clinging to untrue information presents itself as a cruel hoax to women who are seriously concerned about this, and whose concern is heightened by exaggerated and hyped reports about the risk that they face just because of where they live.
That's terrible.
And there's so much misinformation and ignorance about cancer, and I'll freely admit I don't know, you know, nearly as much as you and many other people do. And so we rely on experts. We rely on the media to vet these reports. And what we see here is I'm not going to call it a conspiracy, but there is a kind of collusion to protect what you have defined as a myth in order, presumably, to preserve streams of funding from organizations that exploit breast cancer as a way to build a brand name and market products of door-to-door cosmetic sales.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head, Peter. I mean, I don't necessarily think there's any particularly nefarious individuals involved here, although there certainly are some scientists that are acting in unscientific manners, in my opinion. But it's just kind of the way the system rolled along. You know, money is what greases the system, and the money was available to study why wealthy white women were supposedly getting more breast cancer as opposed to why are African-American women dying more. Because the money is put out there by the husbands of wealthy white women, you know. And it's really terrible because, you know, a lot of people have walked in fear for well over 25 years here in the Bay Area that they were more susceptible to breast cancer. And that means that the minute they get a DCIS reading on their mammogram, they're more apt to get like a double mastectomy, preventative mastectomy, or to undergo, you know, toxic chemotherapy or radiation, which can cause breast cancer. This whole, you know, treatment regime, which, you know, arguably does some good in the world, but arguably does some harm in the world. They're more prone to enter that regime and to trust these experts that are making money off of their procedures because they don't know all the stuff that I revealed in Busted. I didn't know it, you know. I mean, this is new information for people, and if I've done my job correctly, I presented it in a way that is understandable and graspable and that our local elected officials and public health officials should take to heart and fix and reform this because, you know, it's a terrible thing for a woman to go in fear and have a double mastectomy when it's not necessary.
Well, I know a woman who did just that, and I cringe to think that she did so in the face of false information.
Well, you know, a lot of women think that this 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer thing, which we put to rest in the last episode that we just recorded. They run in fear because organizations that make money off of fear are been promoting incorrect scientific notions, notions based on unscientific data, I should say.
Peter Byrne, one of the people you interviewed for your Busted series is Christine Clark. She is the lead epidemiologist with the Cancer Prevention Institute of California. And we have a clip, but you tell me that you conducted a lengthy interview that you videotaped with her. And then this was a follow-up session? Is that what we're about to hear, or is it from that?
It's from that, and what happened was I interviewed her at the offices of the Cancer Prevention Institute in Fremont on videotape about a year ago, and we had a wide-ranging discussion. Christina Clark is the author or co-author of almost all of the major papers claiming that there's a high elevated risk rates of breast cancer in Marin, and that is caused by hormone replacement therapy or something unknown, which they can't put their finger on, but that it's not excessive mammography. Paper after paper that Dr. Clark wrote insisted that even though excess mammography could theoretically explain the breast cancer cluster in Marin, she didn't think it was so. But after we talked for an hour and a half, towards the end of our conversation, she had this to say.
Mammography, I mean, we basically said that it's a possibility.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility.
Can you assign that like a 10%?
No, I can't put a number on that, but there's no question that better and perhaps more intense mammography could have played into that pattern and could still be playing into that pattern, to your point.
Because it detects more cancer, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So she told me, absolutely, that mammography could explain the so-called breast cancer cluster in Marin. Now, this is very interesting, Peter, because in October, the organization that Dr. Clark works for put out a paper that was joined by the people at the Marin Department of Health claiming that basically breast cancer incident rates in Marin are falling and that we don't need to worry anymore about what has been called an epidemic for 25 years. It's a really specious piece of work, and I will explain that indeed the rates of breast cancer have been falling in Marin as they have everywhere else in the United States, and the reasons for that are people aren't smoking as much and, you know, some effects of treatment and stuff. And when Christina Clark and the Department of Health in Marin County claimed that Marin's breast cancer epidemic was basically over, they did it on the basis that the rates had fallen in Marin. However, when they were claiming that there was a breast cancer epidemic, they didn't do it on the basis simply of comparing rates in Marin from 1 year to the next to it themselves, or apples to apples. They did it by comparing the rates in Marin to the California average, which would be apples to oranges, which is the only way you can make a comparison of whether or not there's more of a disease in a certain population. But in the new paper, they don't go there. They don't talk about the Marin rates actually still being higher than the California average, which they are. And they are higher because people in Marin are getting ever more mammograms than before. Kaiser has put out data saying that over 90% of women over 50 that they treat get regular annual mammograms. You know, the fear is still there. People are still getting mammograms. So, you know, as our story progressed, my investigation progressed, and right before it was published, they put out this study, which is, I think, pseudoscience. And when I had asked her about it, you know, she still claimed that wealthy white women are more at risk. in the same breath that she said that the breast cancer epidemic in Marin was over. So I can only think that she is not grounded in the scientific method, and that she seems to say stuff that's just spur of the moment, and there's no rhyme or reason for it.
Well, but this is this a kind of a public relations gambit to elide past having to admit that they were wrong? And is it, in fact, indirect acknowledgement of the accuracy of your reporting?
I believe that what you just said is true. I think that, you know, the Cancer Prevention Institute of California has two or maybe three professional public relations officials on its payroll, which are taxpayer-funded, by the way. They have a $275 million contract with the National Cancer Institute to do this, plus other funding from the CDC. I mean, it's a very well-funded organization. And clearly, the public relations gambit here is to now say, well, they're never the epidemic is over, and it was caused by hormone replacement therapy, and so we can all go on with our lives now. Now, I actually think these people should all be held accountable,
mm-hmm.
because in actuality, women are still frightened, and until the Cancer Prevention Institute of California and the Cancer Registry and the Marin Department of Health come forward and state in big, bold headlines that can be printed in the Chronicle, we were wrong, we're sorry, they're going to still be in fear, and mm-hmm. they're still going to get overtreated.
Mm-hmm. Now, Peter, one thing that comes to mind as a layperson here is we haven't really touched on heredity or DNA as a factor in breast cancer diagnosis. Are there any lines of data that support heredity or anomalies in one's DNA that could be hereditary or might not be that contribute to the incidence of breast cancer diagnosis?
That's a great question, Peter. Unfortunately, the way that breast cancer epidemiology, or indeed cancer epidemiology, is set up, first of all, it's highly dependent on federal funding, and they have guidelines. And they feds insist that all the patients be categorized according to race, which is their self-reported race in whatever forms they fill out. And so when when the Department of Health was taking this money from Avon to study women in Marin, of which they studied like well over 14,000 women who were getting mammograms, they decided to exclude non-white women from most of the studies. There was one small one which included non-white women, but the predominant study regime was based on only studying white women and deliberately excluding non-white women.
Globally, the population in Marin is 90% white, right?
Actually, no. 28% of the population in Marin is non-white.
Oh, really?
Which is Asian, Latino, uh-huh. Indian, you know, African-American, you know, you name it. Any number of those women are on the same economic scale as the white women. You know, there's no good reason to exclude non-white women from the study of breast cancer in Marin if you want to find out whether or not there's some kind of danger here, which could be environmental or whatever. And using race in epidemiology is something that hopefully will not be with us too much longer, because race is a social construct. It's not a biological construct. It's not valid science to divide populations according to race. It might be good to do that, and is good to do that, to divide populations for sociological studies. But for studies based on the biology of cancer, it's insane. And the reason for that is, as the Human Genome Project revealed 15 years ago, ancestry is a valid path for looking at causes of diseases. Ancestry, which can be traced through genetic pathways. But race is not something that genes follow on a genetic pathway.
Okay.
For instance, the National Cancer Institute includes under the rubric of white Afghanis, Poles, Finns, Russians, Americans, and Zoroastrians. There's like over 100 different nationalities included as white. Now, obviously, all those people have different gene pools. So if mm-hmm. you're doing a genetic analysis of breast cancer causation and you divide it by race, you've got yourself into a pocket where you can't possibly decide whether or not there's an effect that's genetic because you're not you've incorrectly confounded it with race. And when you divide, say, whites from Zoroastrians or Afghanis on the basis of race, you can't track the genetics of it.
So Matthew Willis, who is the director of public health here in Marin, he's not the full director of public health.
No, he's the chief medical officer.
Chief medical officer. He gave you an interview, and he addressed some of your questions about the use of race, didn't he?
Yeah, I had a sit down. I interviewed Dr. Willis and the other epidemiologists at Marin numerous times and had a lot of contact with them over the year I was doing this investigation. They had to give me a lot of public records, and we discussed all these issues at great length. And ultimately, last summer, I sat down with Dr. Willis and Rochelle Ehrman and Liam Prebill, who are the epidemiologists in charge of the breast cancer program for Marin, and asked them a lot of the questions that I've talked about today. And one of the primary questions I asked was why they decided to disaggregate all the non-white people from studies of biological causation of breast cancer in Marin if they thought there was actually an epidemic here. And their counterarguments didn't really hold any water. And ultimately, Dr. Willis basically said,
basically, I'm taking a step back, like, Your piece is going to help us, as a society, move forward in terms of our understanding of. I mean, the reason things change mm-hmm. is because people ask questions.
So I think that that's a good thing when, a medical professional like Dr. Willis is basically positioning himself to say, okay, well, maybe we were wrong, maybe our methods aren't the best way forward. You know, that's kind of, I applaud that. As opposed to the Cancer Prevention Institute people, which won't even talk to me, or the people at the Cancer Registry, which just give me canned comments and stuff. I mean, the people at Marin County actually were the only ones that readily gave up the public records that they were required to give under law, but they did it when I didn't have to, cajole them to do it, and they would sit down and talk to me. And I think that, Matt and Rochelle and Leanne are genuinely interested in the health and well-being of the populace. I think they were mistaken to be led down the path that the Cancer Prevention Institute and Avon enticed them onto by paying their salaries. But there's always room for improvement, and I personally am looking forward to the Department of Health apologizing to the women of Marin County and then moving ahead to make redress.
And you did invite Dr. Willis to join us for this discussion today, and he sent you a pretty polite response saying he didn't have enough time to schedule it, and he just offered a compliment that your work is raising important questions, something to that effect. So he's not adopting a defensive posture or demonizing you for pursuing the facts.
Right. And in his email to me declining the invitation, he congratulated us on accurately representing the facts in a well-written article. So I think that's great, that stands out from the attitude that I got from the Cancer Registry, which is highly defensive. I related previously, I'd asked for the internal audits from the Cancer Registry, and it took me about 6 months to pry them loose. And towards the end of that, I put in a public records request for all the internal emails at the Cancer Registry, which is run by at that level by the Department of Public Health state in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I wanted all the emails that had anything to do with my public records request, which I thought was sly, And ultimately, they gave me 3,000 pages of emails, and it was all between high-ranking officials in the Department of Health and the people at the Cancer Prevention Registry and people at the National Cancer Institute and the CDC in Washington, D.C., basically saying, how can we keep this guy from getting his hands on this data? Mm-hmm. And at one point, they realized that they were going to have to give it to me, and one of them suggested that they approach the owner of the Point Reyes Light to see if some deal could be made. And then another high-ranking official, when asked if this was going to cause harm to the Cancer Registry, said, Byrne connected the dots between the audit reports, you know, whatever that means, connected the dots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were like pretty freaked out. But they had to give me the records, and they did, which is good because otherwise they would have committed a felony. And the rest is history. The online version of Busted links to all of these audits. And if you go and you read it online, every audit that I got is described, and there's a link that will take you to the actual source material. And that goes for all 11 parts. Every single scientific paper that is referenced in this, you can read yourself if you want,
mm-hmm.
And all the data sets and everything else. It could freely open to the public. That's why I love internet publication, online publication, you know, because you don't have to take the reporter's word anymore. You can actually go look at the sources.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, we have one more clip here from, I think, Dr. Benz. You want to set us up for that?
Dr. Benz is a lead scientist at the Buck Institute on Aging based in Novato here in Marin County. And they were partners with the Marin Department of Health in the Marin Women's Study.
And let me just interject for our listeners who've never heard of the Buck Trust. A woman named Beryl Buck passed away in Marin County decades ago and left a small fortune in oil stocks that became a huge fortune. And she decreed in her will that the money had to be spent for the health and welfare of the people of Marin County. And one of the projects that came out of Beryl Buck's trust is the Buck Center on Aging. They spent huge to build a fancy edifice designed, I think, by I.M. Pei. And it sits up on a hillside as you drive up the 101 freeway through Novato. And they are doing some interesting research there. Tell us what you found when you went to talk to Dr. Benz.
Well, you know, arguably they do a lot of fine research, but in this case, the Marin Department of Health was taking money from Avon, which was finding its way to the Buck Institute as well. And one of the things that they were doing with the Marin Women's Study was they were collecting saliva samples so they could look at genetic markers in it. But the collection process was flawed. They were basically asking people to spit 2 teaspoons into a little plastic container before 11 o'clock in the morning and before they brushed their teeth or ate or anything like that, and then mail them back. So it was a flawed collection process because it was too easily contaminated by bacteria, and you couldn't really, you know, it was unscientific, you know, to do that. And he was one of the people that was in charge of surveying that. And so when I called him, I wanted to ask him about that, and basically the problem was that those saliva samples are sitting there now because all the funding has been stopped. They're maybe of no use, and maybe they never were. And one of the reasons, just to digress for a second, that the funding was stopped, in my opinion, is because the Department of Health had decided to look for evidence of cadmium in these saliva samples, and cadmium is a possible carcinogen that is found in cosmetics. And at that point, Avon stopped funding their project. And when I asked Dr. Benz, he said, well, that was coincidental. But then I went on to ask him about whether or not screening mammography utilization could explain the excess mammography in Marin, and he got a little testy.
And that we cannot explain the decline, that the correlation and the decline in the use of HRT, combined E plus P, and the decline in the incidence rate, we cannot explain that by some change in the screening incidence in this county.
Why not?
I'm sorry. I've gone beyond the time I can spend talking to you, and this is just no longer productive, and I'm not really interested in pursuing it in greater detail with you.
Very good. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Well, that was a little terse goodbye.
Yeah. Well, he had been saying some things before that that are, in my opinion, were not in conformance with the data that is readily available regarding mammographic utilization. And, you know, one of the things that Christopher Benz had been involved with, along with the Department of Health, was trying to look at these saliva samples to find some kind of genetic correlation between genes that cause breasts to be dense and breast cancer risk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of crazy to do that because younger women have denser breasts. As you get older, your breasts get less dense. The reason that there is some kind of correlation between breast cancer risk and breast density is because when you have dense breasts, which means that the proportion of muscle and milk ducts and lobules is greater than the proportion of fat in some women's breasts. About half of all women have dense breasts. The X-rays can't penetrate it as readily, so you get false positives more often.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a biological causation. It's an artifact of an inadequate screening process. And they were looking for these correlations and trying to tie it to the breast density of women that had not given birth before the age of 30. And their claim was that if you gave birth before the age of 30, you would have less dense breasts later in life, and that would be protective. But that was crazy, because you're going to have a less dense breasts later in life anyway, which is a consequence of aging. And what we came down to was, and there was no genetic proof whatsoever of this, the whole study was like really, in my opinion, quite specious, was that the Marin Department of Health was advocating quite publicly, based on this like pseudoscience, in my opinion it was a pseudoscience, that women should start giving birth to children under the age of 30. And they were saying that women in Marin are career women, and they're not doing that, and because of their not being mothers at a young age, they've put themselves at risk of breast cancer. They widely promoted that notion, and I find that to be rather strange.
Yeah. And Peter, in our first episode, you explained these parallel paths, but they are separate. That the incidence of breast cancer increases between age 50 and 70, but there is still some risk for a woman, say, between age 20 and 50. And when we talk about the issue of density of the breast tissue, and again, this is a layperson speaking, but it strikes me that during the period of fertility and possible lactation, that the breast tissue would likely be denser, and that once a woman passes the age of fertility, that it's likely that the density would decline. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that's very accurate. Now, the whole breast density issue is related to the issue of whether or not estrogen levels, whether or not high estrogen levels promote breast cancer chemically. And it's unknown. It may be that is true, but it's unknown. And the problem with breast density in the younger people, like I said, is that although the statistics show that there's a 2% chance that between the ages of 0 and 50, a woman living in America will get diagnosed with breast cancer, that doesn't mean she's got breast cancer.
Yeah.
It could be a false positive. And in fact, the rate of false positives is such that by the time you have 10 mammograms, you're guaranteed to have a false positive. And any time you have a mammogram, the chance of getting a false positive is about 50%. Which actually, Dr. Clark, you know, mentioned that when I interviewed her. She said that she herself doesn't really like to go that route because of the false positive rate is so high. And the problem with false positives is that When a radiographer reads a mammogram and thinks that it's suspicious for breast cancer and writes that down on a piece of paper, it automatically becomes a breast cancer in the cancer registry.
Yeah.
And since the cancer registry doesn't really do any follow-up, there's never a chance for it to be corrected. So it's just rife with false positives all over the place, that even though the woman might not have been treated because somebody determined she got a second opinion and they decided it wasn't breast cancer, which everybody should go to at least three pathologists, I'm going to say. It just means, as we obviously know from the internal audits, that especially with breast cancer, the registry is full of false positives and it's full of non-cancerous and overdiagnosis. So the 1 in 8 figure is based on faulty data to start with.
We're talking with Peter Byrne, science writer, investigative reporter, the author of Busted, the 11-part series published by The Point Reyes Light. And Peter, you just talked about false positives and that if you have 10 mammograms, it's likely that one of them would produce a false positive. There is another risk associated with mammography itself. And in the sixth installment of your series, you write about the perils of mammography, and you cite studies from Canada and also Denmark. Tell our listeners a little bit about the downside of frequent mammograms.
You know, this is interesting because I wanted to get this story published years ago. I wanted to be commissioned by a newspaper or a magazine to write the story. Nobody would touch it. It was a third rail because it concerned mammography. But now it's become very clear. I mean, even the New York Times had a headline earlier this year about the harms of mammography. The only way to test whether or not mammography works is to have 25 or 30-year-long clinical trials in which a certain number of women get mammograms and a certain number don't, and then you see who gets more breast cancer. The best trial, widely recognized as the best designed trial and best conducted trial, was done in Canada at the University of Toronto. And they just concluded, I think it was their 25-year mark, and published the results. And these results are echoed by a number of other studies. There's only been about 10 major clinical trials, and 8 of them, I think, echo this, that mammography causes more harm than good. I'm sad to say that the indication is that for every 1,000 women that are invited to have a mammogram, which is distinct from having a mammogram, they're invited to have a mammogram, one life may be saved by actually inviting people to have a mammogram.
Wow.
But up to 500 lives may be beset by false positives and overdiagnosis and treatments that they don't need, and that radiation itself causes a significant number of breast cancers. So if you look at it from a social point of view, from whether or not it's good for society, mammography clearly is not good for society. And, you know, this has been debated in various ways, but the debate's over. I mean, if you read my part on the perils of mammography, it's all laid out. You can link to the studies. There really is no room for a debate anymore. Mammography causes more harm than good on a social basis. Now, if you're that one woman in 1,000 whose life is saved by getting a mammogram, you're going to think differently. Mm-hmm. But we do live in a democracy, so if you want to put it up for a vote, that one woman against the 500 that are harmed, I have no doubt which side would win. It's a thorny question, and I think the upshot of it is that any woman that wants to think about getting a mammogram needs to have make an informed choice. And women have not been given accurate information about the perils of mammography or about how breast cancer incident rates are calculated or what the 1 in 8 figure means. It's a lifetime risk that is minuscule compared to what it sounds like. And it's time for women to start getting that information so that women can make informed choices about whether or not they want to get mammograms, not to mention if they get a diagnosis, whether they want to get a second or third opinion, and then whether or not they want to get treatments.
So this type of screening is putting at least some women at greater risk than if they didn't have it. And you show that the combined Danish and Canadian studies surveyed at least 600,000 women. So these are not small samples, you know, that could produce anomalous outcomes. And so that is a pretty stunning conclusion that you reach, Peter.
Yeah, up to half of the women that get mammograms are invited for mammograms. It's statistically meaningful, but we don't have to talk about why. Up to half the women that are invited to mammograms can be harmed by them. And, you know, that's a big deal. But there's an entire industry. I mean, I think Dow Chemicals is one of the manufacturers of mammography machines. You know, they're pharmaceutical companies like mammograms because it gets when you get diagnosed, you use their very, very expensive drugs. I mean, a lot of this boils down to, you know, what I said in like the very last paragraph of my series where I finally interjected my own opinion that it's insane to have a medical system run on a for-profit basis. I mean, single-payer healthcare, otherwise known as socialized medicine, is the only logical way forward. If you take the profit motive out of it, none of this would happen in the same way.
Well, I fully agree with you. For years, I've been declaring that the for-profit delivery of healthcare is a huge failure. And the sooner we acknowledge that and get the insurance companies and rein in the pharmaceutical companies and the HMOs, we're not going to fix the problem.
Nobody could do a worse job than the system that is going on now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we agree on that. Now, Peter, one of the things that, as we've been discussing both in part 1 and part 2 of our podcast series here, is the California Cancer Registry, in your opinion, and you've looked at this very carefully and studied their own internal audits, they're providing subpar data. To what extent, you described how if a technician or a dermatologist detects a cancer, they report it, even if that's not an accurate report and if it's not sustained by, for example, a biopsy that follows. And so that's just one example of how erroneous information gets into this massive database. Are there also problems where underpaid and underqualified people are entering the data into the system, and confusion and inaccuracies occur as a result of low-budget personnel performing what can be sophisticated analysis?
Well, according to the progress reports issued by the Cancer Registry itself, they have a problem getting qualified computer programmers because they're forced to hire from the list of government employees that are have seniority, as opposed to, you know, some young college graduate with Silicon Valley chops, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other problem is that their software is outdated. There's like 10 regional cancer registries run by a handful of nonprofits, and they all use different software systems. There's structural problems in getting the data from the doctor's office or the hospitals to the cancer registry. But once it's there, there's problems in ascertaining the levels of accuracy of the coding that's in it. This is, in my opinion, an intractable problem. I think the registry, it was a mistake to set up the cancer registry to start with, to do an impossible job. You could do it under a single payer system in which you know, I had a central entity was handling all the medical problems that a person presents, like they do in Canada or France or England or any number of civilized countries. Then you actually have a much better chance of tracking your entire population. And if you're going to do epidemiological research, you don't want to be missing people. You know, that throws it off and biases it and makes it irrelevant. And that's one of the problems with the cancer registry data that's been used for, you know, any number of epidemiological studies in California, was that it's missing data. It's got huge gaps in it. Wouldn't really, you know, there's no reason to trust that data because the cancer registry itself admits that it's erroneous and filled with, you know, gaps and miscoding and stuff like that.
And Peter, from your series, let me just quote a couple of the verbatim citations that you published from the audit reports of the cancer registry. A May 2012 audit of the original records of a large oncology group reported that the registry had failed to record whether or not the group's patients had received radiation treatment in 83% of sampled cases. A June 2012 audit showed that abstractors incorrectly coded the stages of prostate cancers in 17% of sampled cases, and 70% of those 17% were based on errors in coding directions that are clearly stated in the manual. So that suggests underqualified people entering the information. And one more, an April 2012 audit comparing registry records to hospital medical records revealed that 14 out of 15 sampled breast cancer cases contained diagnostic errors. Now, I just picked these, you know, from this whole stack that you published. But that evidence is pretty damning.
Well, one of the problems that's revealed there, too, is that invasive breast cancers are being labeled as non-invasive, and non-invasives are being labeled in the registry records as invasive, which is a terrible thing. And these are samples, right? Now, I'll come to the defense of the poor abstractors that are on the ground trying to do this. I mean, they have an impossible job. For one thing, the codes keep changing periodically, and there's thousands of codes, and the manual itself says things like you can label a cancer as actual if the doctor writes suspicious for malignancy. But there's nothing in the manual that tells you you have to go back next month and see, you know, if the pathology report actually agreed with the doctor's diagnosis, or if they did surgery and found that there wasn't any cancer, or conversely that there was when, you know, in like another place. So without follow-up, the cancer registry is fairly useless. Now, There are a group of scientists, Professor Michael Hogarth at UC Davis, who works with the Cancer Registry and is an expert in information systems, medical information systems, and Dr. Laura Esserman at UCSF, and some other doctors and scientists in the Bay Area have been loudly calling to reform the Cancer Registry and to transform it from its quixotic task of trying to track every cancer in California, which is basically impossible under our given for-profit healthcare system, into a system in which can be used in real time to monitor the quality of care that is given to individual patients, where using electronic records, which have their own set of problems, there's more instantaneous access to all the providers that are treating any one given patient to the history of their case. You know, this is an important thing to think about, because basically in our system, the doctor controls the narrative of a person's disease, and that narrative is written down in a series of records. And if the records are wrong, then the narrative is going to be wrong, and the patient is going to suffer harm because of that.
Mm-hmm. Peter, one of the other issues related to the Cancer Registry that troubled me from your reporting is the role of Dr. Kenneth Kaiser. You referred to him in our first episode. He's a professor at the University of California, Davis, but he also controls the contract to manage the data gathered by the Cancer Registry. Now, he actually designed the original registry years ago, and he's a fairly prominent public health official in the state of California. But what you describe, and you didn't use these words, but it appears to be a kind of self-dealing where he has maneuvered to be the major domo of cancer data collection in California, and yet he seems to be sitting atop a really he's got a $29 million five-year grant to run this program at UC Davis. And it strikes me at minimum he has too much power. And on the upper end, it appears that he may have a self-interest in protecting the image or the perception of the credibility of the data, even though he knows that based on your reporting and perhaps others, that that's not really the case.
I think that's an accurate summation of the situation in this $29 million contract that Dr. Kaiser controls. Originated because the registry was just imploding, and by like 2012, according to its own internal documents, it had so many software problems and coding problems that the Department of Health, the powers that be, decided to put out new contracts and get rid of some of the nonprofits that were involved and had been involved for a long time. They ended up winnowing it down to the Cancer Prevention Institute, has a large chunk of the state in the north, the Public Health Institute, which we haven't talked about, which is a mammoth institute based in Oakland, has been basically, it was running the operations of the Cancer Registry on behalf of the state for many, many years and is responsible for the problems that occurred during its watch, but it still has a contract. And then the University of Southern California runs the Los Angeles area. I didn't really look at Los Angeles, but if you have anybody out there that wants to encourage me to do that, I will. And the problem was that the system, as it had been designed by Dr. Kaiser back in the mid-1980s, wasn't working and hadn't been working and never did work according to what it was set up to do. It was just really marginal. And so he got this contract for his institute for public health improvement, I think it's called, at UC Davis, to run all the data operations of the registry. Unfortunately, it was beyond the capabilities of his group, and he had to outsource a private company to take charge of the computer programming and the data crunching, because his group was not capable of doing it, according to public records. Dr. Kaiser and I had some email exchanges, but he would only work, he would only communicate with me through his public relations people, and he was quite contemptuous of my questions, but he did answer them to the best of his ability, I suppose.
And did you find him forthcoming?
No, I found him extremely defensive. And, you know, I'm sorry, but he's been running this broken cancer registry for 30 years. It's time to step aside.
As I'm thinking, I'm reminded of the current governor of Michigan, whose emergency manager powers led to the change in the water supply in Flint, for which the buck stops with him. And he gave his state of the speech, state of the state speech recently and said, I'm going to fix it.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to have confidence in somebody who wrecked a system who claims that they're going to fix it for you.
Well, you know, that's a problem. And at a deeper level, you know, I've kind of outed these problems here for the public. But the jargon and the opacity of this system is just mind-boggling. I mean, basically, I had to learn a lot of epidemiology and science to be able to penetrate this and to figure out where things were going wrong. And I had to do public records requests and fight them for records that showed in plain language that there was these huge intractable problems that they were incapable of fixing. But they would have just kept going on forever like this, you know, if just making a few tweaks here and there, because I'm sorry, but the system's lifeblood is government funding, you know, and at the CDC and the NCI are not watching the store at all. They're just throwing money at California and similar registries around the country. And their idea of an audit is basically if the registry can meet certain goals that they have set up that are actually unprofessional goals, that are goals that are meaningless, they can continue receiving hundreds of millions of dollars. I think over the life of the cancer registry here, about $1 billion has gone into it.
Really?
In the nonprofits that are running it. I mean, the Public Health Institute got over $200 million for running it into the ground for the first 20 years, you know. So it's a lot of money involved and a lot of careers, and there's a code, you know, among people not to rock the boat. And, you know, that's not to say that some people have not rocked the boat, because Dr. Alice Whitmore at Stanford, a highly regarded epidemiologist, wrote a paper back in 2003 saying that there was no breast cancer epidemic in Marin, that it was an artifact of mammography, and that the issue was more psychological. She wondered why people have are affected by the irrational capacity to believe in data that contradicts their emotional beliefs, which is a good question that everybody in this country should ask them themselves. And in this case, unfortunately, I would say that the harm that's being caused in Flint is not dissimilar to the harm that is being caused by women who are being manipulated by a system that does not have public health as its highest goal.
Very well put, Peter. We opened in part one of this two-part podcast series. Early on, we talked about the case of Dr. Renee Willard. And let's wrap up by describing the real-life case of a woman who doesn't want to be identified, but you call her Abigail Adams in your final installment.
Right, she's a businesswoman in Marin County, and we sat down, and she showed me all the medical records that she had kept from being diagnosed with breast cancer three times during the last 15 years. And she even had tape recordings of sessions with her doctors, which she obtained with their permission. And she sent away for her record at the cancer registry, which came, and then we sat down and decoded it, and it was mostly incorrect. She had been diagnosed with various forms of ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, and had undergone various biopsies and surgical type procedures that were extremely debilitating and painful. And by the time it showed up in the registry, the record of her life experiences was mostly inaccurate and not well reflected, and basically ended up attributing invasive cancers to Marin that didn't exist.
And she had a lumpectomy, at least in one of those rounds.
She did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was, you know, she described a situation that was, you know, somewhat torturous, which I think any woman that's been through biopsy procedures would understand. You know, the fear and the pain that's associated with breast cancer is overwhelming, and this ridiculous notion that women are brave survivors, you know, doesn't resonate with the women I talk to. They said, you know, this was something terrible that happened to me that didn't need to happen, mm-hmm. you know.
Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a powerful book about her experiences as a breast cancer patient, and she is quite aggressive in challenging the whole nomenclature of patients as, you know, these courageous warriors who wage this battle and you know, hope to prevail. And the way that has been co-opted by commercial interests, from the Komen Foundation to Avon, which is a central player in your story and in the situation here in Marin County.
Well, there's a Cold War mentality behind the entire so-called war on cancer, based on radiation, based on devices that were invented for military applications. Chemotherapy is based on mustard gas. You know, radiation treatments are based on radar. You know, and the language that is used. You know, you fight cancer. Right. You know, it's a war on cancer. I mean, mm-hmm. my brother, God bless him, died last Thanksgiving of lung cancer, and I had the privilege of communicating with him a lot in the last year of his life. You know, and he would say, "I don't feel like I'm fighting anything. I feel like you know, my system is something that has not turned against me so much as I've turned against it." Hmm. You know, he had, you know, he smoked,
yeah.
you know, but he didn't consider it to be a battle. He considered it to be a condition.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he died. And some people are fortunate enough not to die. And, you know, that's a good thing. But does that make them braver than my brother? I don't think so. My brother faced his death with great dignity, and I guess some people would say he lost the battle, but I don't think so. I think he won.
Peter Byrne, thanks for joining me here for these two very special podcasts. Thanks for all the work you put in to the Busted series, and I hope ultimately you're going to get that apology that Marin County deserves from those who misled us about breast cancer here in the area just north of San Francisco.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it a lot.
My thanks to reporter Peter Byrne for sharing his investigation with us. And I welcome your feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.